Good evening. With that being said, growing up here, right, I grew accustomed to when you get up in front of people and you say good morning, the response is good morning back. And that was something I always did when I was teaching high school, would start with a good morning and a good morning back. Then as I started going to speaking at more churches, I found they don't always say good morning or good evening back to you. But so I appreciate that, and I'm glad that you're here. I notice, if I'm correct in this, with several visitors from around, I know some that I've actually met first at visitors in Mount Pleasant and not visitors here first. But I'm glad that you've made your way out tonight. I also know when you've been working a full day to round up the kids or whatever it takes to be here is a challenge, but I appreciate that and the encouragement that you're giving to me for being here. So we'll be looking at Ephesians chapter 4, at least the first 16 verses. We're going to take smaller chunks going forward, which I think will help us out. And Paul shifts in chapter 4 to what was kind of big picture themes of the Christian life or God's mission, now to coming down to their level to say, all right, here's what all of that means and how you need to treat one another and you need to treat the people that you will come across. And at the beginning of chapter 4, it appears that he will cite sort of a foundational set of sayings that were common in the churches, that was sort of a unifying confession from the churches to say, this is what we believe as Christians. My wife and I, this was a couple of years ago, we bought a new van. And I'm not ashamed to drive a van. When you're packing the kids in, you're doing lots of traveling, having the van is really nice. So I recommend it to you. But when I bought the van, and you've probably had a new car before yourself, you probably didn't go home, as I didn't, and say, well, let me get out the owner's manual, right? Let me start page one of the owner's manual and sort of work my way through that book. Now, maybe you're a car person. That's how you have fun at night, but that's not me. When I have a problem, though, with the car, that's when I get the owner's manual out. I start looking up, all right, what's going on with the tire? Or why isn't my window rolling down or whatever, to seek out and to go back to it to find an answer for the problem. So Paul will take them back to sort of a foundational understanding of a common Christian confession and set of beliefs and actions to remind them of who they are, lest they begin to drift backwards into their old way of life. And so this evening, we'll look at sort of two aspects of this. He will center around unity, which is something we've touched on already, the unity of Jew and Gentile, but he will begin to flesh out how you maintain that unity, and then look at roles of the Christian's gifts, the role of teachers and leaders in the church to make sure that the church is remaining unified and growing and being strengthened. So we want to keep those two themes in our mind as we work our way through it. Well, let's take the first section of this, the first six verses here, and that'll give us a good introduction to it. So Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 1. Therefore I, the prisoner of the Lord, implore you to walk in a manner worthy of the calling with which you have been called, with all humility and gentleness, with patience, showing tolerance for one another in love, being diligent to preserve the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. There is one body and one Spirit, just as also you were called in one hope of your calling, one Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of all, who is over all and through all and in all. So it opens with a call to unity, a call to walk in the manner worthy of the way they have been called. And you notice the repetition of Paul to drive that point home. What they have been called and are meant to do, preserving and maintaining the unity of believers. And he, that's not an abrupt change of thought on his part, right, in which he's sketched out the larger themes in chapters 1, 2, and 3, kind of the big picture, deep ideas of God's great cosmic plan. But now he's switching to, so then walk the way you are supposed to, right? If that story is true, if chapters 1 through 3 is true, then live by it, right? Show that it's true by the way that you live. Walk worthy of that calling. They are inseparable, this great story in the Christian life. Paul again identifies himself, as he did in chapter 3, as a prisoner, which I don't think is incidental Because what he's going to call them to do, the way of life he's going to encourage them to live by, is the same type of life that led to Paul being in prison. So he's going to tell them up front, living this way will not be easy. It will not win you many friends. It will not make your day-to-day go by smoother. It might make it much more difficult, and you too might end up in prison. So he doesn't sugarcoat the scenario of being a Christian and make it appear a much simpler life than it is. He says, no, I, as a prisoner of Jesus, I'm the one that's telling you to live this way and to bring it under the Lord. Again, this increasing reference that he will make about Jesus, and something that will come up in the final section of our lesson tonight. The emphasis here, again, on Jesus being the Lord, submitting yourself under him in all thoughts and actions and behaviors to live true, true allegiance. So this idea of being called and the gospel message, this, I'm going to try and not take us down a rabbit hole too much, but this idea of the gospel message, this good news, that is language in the Roman Empire that you would announce good news to somebody when a new Caesar was put on the throne, right? Because if you have your Caesar killed, right, if he's assassinated or he dies, then you worry about, well, what's going to happen next? Is this going to be chaos? Is it going to be rebellion? Is it going to be civil war? What's going to happen? Well, good news, we've got a new king. But Paul will go around in the same world and say, well, I do have good news for you. There is a new king, and it's Jesus. And so live your life in obedience and allegiance to him. So with this idea of virtue, so he's talked of unity. He's talked about this in chapters 2 and 3. Jew and Gentile, no matter the background, no matter who you are, what you've done, being put into this one body, this one new humanity. And he will offer a series of character traits, ways that they need to think about themselves and others and their way of life, a set of character traits that will be essential for them to live in unity. You know, our churches, I guess, are no different now in that you throw together quite a mixture of people into one congregation with lots of backgrounds and experiences that now are put together to say, well, now act as one, right? Be unified together, which is a difficult task in any circumstance, and perhaps especially true in churches. So he's calling for them to walk worthy of unity. Well, how do you do that? He tells them first in verse 2 to do so with humility, that it's going to take to have unity, it's going to take a person being humble. I guess this speaks to the cultural impact of Christianity. We want to say humility is a good trait. Perhaps we don't always act humble or recognize humility in somebody else, but we at least say it's good for people to be humble. That was not true in the Roman world, okay, the world in which Paul is writing. Humility was not a good trait for a person to have. In fact, it's only said of slaves. Slaves are humble, not kings, not rulers, not powerful, not the intelligent. They are not humble. It is slaves. But Paul here, throughout his letters, will lift up humility as the great Christian virtue. Why would he do that when everybody else tells him it's foolish to be humble? He will do that because Jesus was humble. And you see the transformation that takes place when you say Jesus is your king. When you recognize him as Lord, you see the world differently. So he will put up humility as the great virtue, and it's a testament, I think, to Christianity that it has worked its way into the larger culture, that we will at least say being humble is a good trait when it wasn't always thought that way. So he says it's going to take being humble, take you being concerned about the other person. It's going to take you putting aside perhaps what you might want to see happen or what would be easiest for you for the benefit of the group, of the church, of the other person, because this is the trait incarnated by Jesus. This is the way that he lived. Secondly, he will tell us humility and gentleness. You might have meekness translated there. That's one of those sort of difficult concepts, because gentle is maybe not a strong character trait that we would think of, right? If somebody's gentle, we might think of them real soft-spoken or shy, or they don't stand up to anybody. They're kind of gentle and meek and just sort of shuffle through life. Aristotle, the Greek philosopher, so this would be sort of in the minds of his audience, of a Greek speaking audience, described meekness or gentleness as the medium point, okay, the middle ground between being angry about everything and being angry about nothing. That it's the middle ground. You know when to take a stand, know when to be upset, know how to do it without flying off the handle at every moment, and then always keeping your mouth closed no matter the circumstance. It's finding that middle point. And now you think about how you work that out in a church, of being unified and knowing, well, here's a battle I should fight, and here's a battle I should let go. And that will take a lot of maturity and prayer to know, I think, when those battles are going, which battles are which. But he says, be humble, be gentle, and then my favorite of all of these, be patient. Or literally, have a long fuse. And here's why I like that. This again goes back to Paul saying he's a prisoner. Paul does not lie to you and say being in a church will be easy. And he doesn't lie to you and say you're always going to have warm, fuzzy feelings towards the people that you go to church with, that you're always going to be best friends and like the same things and get along perfectly, that he knows it's going to be tough. And there are going to be times when you have to have patience to deal with the person across from you when they are not living right, when they're saying the wrong things, when they're being mean or rude or neglecting their responsibilities. It's going to take a long fuse. It's going to take patience. And Paul recognizes that. And I'm glad. I would be worried if Paul never mentioned that because then I would think, what's wrong with me? But he acknowledges patience as a necessary component to maintaining this unity. One final element about these virtues. This just goes in language of verse 3. Being diligent to, and I think this is key, preserve the unity. Not being diligent to create unity, because you and I don't create unity in this scenario, right? We don't make the unity. Jesus made the unity, okay, through his death and resurrection, through the bringing together of people under his leadership, under his rule. That's what makes unity. It's our job not to mess it up. It's our job to keep together, okay, to cling to one another in humility and patience and gentleness. So he describes our responsibility to keep the peace, not to make it, but to keep it. Then the basis, and this could be, right, we could have done the whole week on these couple of verses here. Four through six. So, keep us moving forward, I want to speak generally about these things. We won't go into each one individually, but just sort of speak generally about the sorts of things that Paul says. There is some argument, and I find them persuasive, nothing much hangs on this, but that what Paul does here with the oneness, that it must be based on some prior teaching, and that perhaps this is kind of a shorthand. You will see this through the letters of Paul. He will cite traditional formulas or kind of a condensed set of sayings from time to time. Romans opens with one. The hymn, or what's maybe a hymn in Philippians 2 about Christ when he becomes the servant and is elevated. Things that are familiar among the Christians. And even if it's not perhaps a set in stone traditional formula, for him just to say one body, one spirit, one baptism, that would require them to know what those things are beforehand, right? So this is not new information that he's giving to them. He's reminding them of the things that they already know, these essential beliefs and practices of Christians. So a couple of emphases here, and the obvious one is the oneness of these things, in which he says one body and one spirit and one baptism and on and on. There is the oneness here, which is to unite the Christians, to be these center points that the Christians gravitate around, and that's what they cling to and are by extension able to cling to one another because of this common confession, because they each say there is one body and one spirit and one Lord and one baptism and one Father. So these are the types of things that they are unified around. Another thing that is interesting is the way Paul starts in verse 4. He starts with the one body. You typically start these lists with what is most important, and you maybe work your way down to a less important role. An example of this is if you look at the list of the disciples in the Gospels. It always starts with Peter, and it always ends with Judas. Okay, and that's by the author's choice. Okay, you start with sort of the high point, and you move down. If you look at like the later Christian creeds that will come 100 or 200 years after this, they all start with the Father. They all start with God the Father and work their way down. Paul starts with the body and then moves his way down to the Father. That's not to say that could easily be misunderstood, as if the Father is unimportant. But it's striking to me that when Paul wants to start with fundamental, foundational Christian beliefs, he starts with the church first. And that fits what he's been doing in the previous couple chapters, right? Starting with and talking about the importance of the church for the plan of God and the mission of God in the world. So he's put the church right here at the top. You are centered around this idea of the one church working out the plan of God. And also, you notice the Trinitarian flavor, Father, Son, and Spirit, being a part of this too, in which he will cite Spirit, Lord, and God the Father, which fits, again, the larger context, in which he has talked about the role of God the Father, the role of God the Son, Jesus, and God the Spirit, each of them working out this great plan. And he pulls these things together. And I say that because maybe, and this is my problem, maybe not yours, of not always being the best about that, you know, about remembering and understanding Father, Son, and Spirit, and not just maybe the Father or sometimes the Son, but all those three playing their important role. So this oneness ends with this message of hope, or it's there in verse 4, this one hope of your calling, the direction that you are moving, that they share the same goal, the same desire, the same endpoint. So because they share the same direction, right, they all want to end up with the same result, stay together then and accomplish it, right? Move in that direction together. And I will say this, sort of bringing this section to a close. And I know you know this, but it bears repeating. If we're faithful to Paul's instructions to the churches, unless we are fighting to maintain unity, if we are not focused on unity, then we've really missed the message of Paul. If unity is not important to us, if we're not willing to make the sacrifices necessary to be unified, then we haven't really understood what Paul has been telling us. And we've gone off in some other direction, but it's certainly one Paul would not recognize. So let's move to our next section. This idea of maturity that comes out of this or will be necessary for this, beginning in verse 7. But to each one of us, grace was given according to the measure of Christ's gift. Therefore, it says, when he ascended on high, he led captive a host of captives, and he gave gifts to men. Now, this expression, he ascended, what does it mean except that he also had descended into the lower parts of the earth? He who descended is himself also he who ascends far above all the heavens so that he might fill all things. And he gave some as apostles and some as prophets and some as evangelists and some as pastors and teachers for the equipping of the saints for the work of service to the building up of the body of Christ until we all attain to the unity of the faith and of the knowledge of the Son of God to a mature man to the measure of the stature which belongs to the fullness of Christ. As a result, we are no longer to be children, tossed here and there by waves and carried about by every wind of doctrine, by the trickery of men, by craftiness in deceitful scheming. But speaking the truth in love, we are to grow up in all aspects into Him who is the head, even Christ, for whom the whole body, being fitted and held together by what every joint supplies, according to the proper working of each individual part, causes the growth of the body for the building up of itself in love. So he starts with the notion here of the gifts given to each Christian. And I will say and stress again repeatedly, each Christian. I mean, notice the language that Paul uses. But to each one of us, grace was given according to the measure of Christ's gift. So, yes, that is you too. Right? Somebody who says, I don't know what I would contribute to the church, I don't have anything to contribute to the church, has not thought or looked hard enough, right? Or has not had somebody help them find that. Because what Paul says is each one of us has been given this a gift or gifts to contribute to the body. And the reason he thinks that, he quotes from Psalm 68 or a translation of Psalm 68, which there speaks of God conquering his enemies. he takes that and he applies it to Jesus. Jesus has conquered the powers. Run back through chapters 2 and 3 in which he is elevated above and reigns over all of the powers and authorities and principalities. So that Jesus now is the one who reigns. And the image that's being conveyed, when a king would go and conquer, he'd go conquer some city or country or something like that, he would not only fight against them and defeat them, but he would then take their treasure back home and he would give it to his supporters. So there would be like a procession through the main road going through the city, in which the captives would be paraded in front of everyone to show that they had lost. And then the king would give out his rewards to his loyal supporters. Paul takes that language and he applies it to Jesus. Jesus, through the cross and resurrection, has defeated his enemies. Okay, they lost, and because of that, he gives gifts to his followers, to his people. And I love the language of Paul here, and I've had to think through it for myself how all this works out exactly. This idea of was given according to the measure of Christ's gift, that what that conveys is that not only did Christ choose for you the gift to give you, he selected the gift that you would have, or gifts that you would have, but also how much of it you would have. The gift and how much. Now, there are lots of things I wish I was better at, and then I'm confronted with this and think, well, there must be some reason for me not to have that, right? Or for me to have a different set of gifts. But that's true of each of us. So whatever it is that you are talented or skilled at, right, whatever the gift you have to contribute to the church, that is not there by accident, as if a series of fluke events brought you to that place. That it is Christ who gives the gift and the measure of the gift to each one of us. And there's not one of us exempt from that who has been left without a gift. But they are not gifts for my own benefit. You know, given a set of gifts so I can do something that I want with them. I mean, they are gifts given to then direct towards the church, right? Towards the kingdom and furthering this great plan of God. They've been gifts given for a purpose. Think back to chapter 2 and verse 10, created by God for good works. These are the gifts that help us to do that, to accomplish that. We'll come back to that again in a moment. He also speaks of the gifts of leaders in verses 11 and 12. And he lists a variety of offices that have existed in churches and different leadership roles. They are not exhaustive. He doesn't cover them all, but he gives us a good sampling of them. These different Christian leaders that have been put up that they would have known in Ephesus and other churches that have been given by Christ, right, established by Christ for, again, the benefit of the church, to strengthen them. And we're not, again, going to how do you draw dividing lines between what is an evangelist and teacher and all that. But they are there for this purpose of the church. And again, notice Paul's language. We might think, well, why do we have leaders? Well, we have leaders because somebody has to make a decision, right? So you have a leader because they will make the decision. We'll have a leader because they will sort of keep out the bad things and sort of protect us from that. And all those things are true, but again, not what Paul says here. So don't miss what he says. He gave some of us these leadership roles. Why? Verse 12, for the equipping of the saints, for the work of service, for the building up of the body. So Paul, why did God give us these offices and these leadership roles? Because they are there to train and equip other Christians to be doing work, to sort of be developing a next generation of leaderships or leaders there in the moment to use their gifts. So whatever that gift, right, is, going back, that has been given to us by Christ, leaders are then directed to, you go and find that in other people, and you strengthen them and you equip them so that they will use their gifts in their work, right? Put them in the right path with the right support so that they will develop. So that the main drive here for Paul, think of what does a mature congregation look like, or a growing congregation. We could say numbers, right? It looks like the numbers on the board are getting higher, or you get more younger families. That's a sort of a growing church. Again, though, not what Paul says here. He says a growing, maturing church is growing internally first. It is growing from Christians maturing into the image of Christ that he'll talk about in a moment. And these leaders are being given to develop and build up the church and Christians to do this work, right? To do the mission that they were created and saved and redeemed to do. And what will come from this? What will this look like? Verse 13, he gives us the goal that we can attain to the unity of the faith and of the knowledge of the Son of God, to a mature man, to the measure of the stature which belongs to the fullness of Christ. And then he will go on in verse 14 to warn about becoming children. We'll talk about each of these in succession in a moment. Of being tossed about. And verse 15, growing to be people who speak truth in love. At the heart of this, he will say it, say in verse 15, right, that the sort of the second half of this, we are to grow up in all aspects into him, into Christ, into Jesus. What does a maturing church look like? Or a maturing Christian look like? One that is becoming more and more like Jesus, that looks more and more like him. And that is to know more about him, right? To soak ourselves in the Gospels, to know about him, or to soak ourselves in the writings of Paul and the early Christians as they try and tell us and explain to us about Jesus. To be so immersed in that, that we are growing to understand him more and becoming like him ourselves, right? Growing and moving in that direction. Both, I think individually, right, in my life itself, I need to be more like Christ, and then together as a church being more like Christ, the way we function together. Second with that, so we grow to be more like Jesus, we also grow more mature so that we are not tossed about by every doctrine, that we're not deceived. And I want to emphasize that, because this is another example, I think, of maturity, of knowing, right, to strike the right balance. Because the language that he uses to talk about these doctrines, right, that are brought about by the trickery of men, by deceitful scheming, there is something sinister about what's going on, that the Christians might come under the sway of, or someone might manipulate them, and they are too immature in the faith to know they're being manipulated. So he wants them to grow up so that they know when somebody comes to them and starts telling them something about what the old law said or what Jesus was about, they can understand what is part of the traditional teaching and what is something that is being used and corrupted. But this is maturity to know that may be the case, and it may not be the case, that they are being deceived in its craftiness and trickery. We very may well be wrong about something and would need to have the maturity to know, yes, I am wrong here and need to change, and not sort of throw up a barrier and say, well, it's new or different or, you know, I've never heard that before, and so you need to get that out of here, right, and just sort of dismiss it offhand immediately. It takes the maturity to know, let me think through that and pray about it and investigate it and see where I come out. And that is a mature response, not to say, well, if it's new or somebody's telling me, I'm just going to go that direction, or to say, well, I don't care what you have to say, I'm not going. And I guess an example of that, right, is when you and I will talk to people that go to different churches. We had a sit down with some Jehovah's Witnesses a couple of weeks ago, and we sat down, right, we both of us got our Bibles out, and we started going, well, what, you know, it was all about the deity of Jesus. And so we're going, well, what about here? And they're pulling me in places over here. And it takes maturity, because I'm asking of them, right? I want them to be able to see if they are wrong and need to change. And it takes maturity on my part to also be willing to know when to change or adjust if I've been wrong. I will say, to calm your fears, I did not become a Jehovah's Witness after that. But you know, if we expect somebody to give us a fair hearing, are we mature enough and knowledgeable enough to do the same? And if we're not, right, it's okay to say, no, I'm not ready for that, but then we need to get ready for that and become mature and develop in that way. And then third, in this, verse 15, speaking truth in love, or the end of verse 16, building up of itself in love. And I think the truth in love, they go together and must go together. Because some of us are really good at one and not the other. I mean, some of us are really good at this is the truth and this is the way it is and you better get on board with it and I don't care about your feelings or what you're struggling with. This is the truth and don't ask me questions about it. To draw hard lines. And some of us are really good at the love, and I really care about you, and I don't want to upset you, and I don't want to hurt your feelings, right? I want us to be together on this. I want to have compassion. But those cannot be isolated. And Paul does not isolate them to say, well, you have to be a person of truth or you have to be a person of love and you need to choose. And again, if you would look at Jesus, you would find those two things crashing together as a unified whole. You find the one who tells people the truth, but he also loves them in everything that he says and does, ultimately being seen on the cross. So again, truth in love. And what's amazing about this is kind of the circle that Paul argues in which it is love that motivates us. We are motivated by love. And he talked about this in chapter 3. Motivated by the love of Christ, the love of his people, that is what pushes us forward. But as we push forward, we grow in our love, which then causes us to keep moving forward, which then causes us to grow and deepen our love, which then moves us forward, and it keeps this push and drive moving. So each Christian, and bringing this to a conclusion, we'll talk about a couple of things to think about how to put this into practice. Each Christian individually and each group of Christians as a church bears the responsibility of unity and maturity. Bears it, not to push it off and say, well, it's somebody else's job to mature the congregation or to lead me, or, you know, it's somebody else's responsibility and I'll just sit back and be here for the communion or something like that. That it's each of our responsibility to mature, to help others mature, and see that the unity of Christian believers, of Christ followers, is maintained. Each of our responsibilities. Few things, four, I believe, in total. How we can continue living the unity that we are to have, that we are to maintain, but also maturing as Christians. And it is to center in our minds and make a firm decision at the start that unity is essential to what we stand for as Christians. And you could use a marriage analogy of this, right? It'd be a weird married couple that as part of their vows was we'll be unified until we decide it doesn't work out to be unified or differences are too strong or something, you know, then we'll just sort of break up. We say, no, you make a decision to be unified, right? And then you carry that through going forward. Well, the church needs to have that same mentality about one another, and what they stand for as a people, that unity will be maintained. We will have unity. That is where we are going, and whatever sacrifices must be made, I'll do that, right? To give up our pride, to give up what's easiest for us, for what's best for the church, with each of us pledging and maintaining that desire with humility, gentleness, and patience. But, and I will stress this strongly, that unity must be a robust, strong unity. And this is where the truth and the love come together. Because Paul does not open the section with, be unified and just sort of believe whatever you want and tolerate whatever you want and just make sure that you still come to the same building and you still put your money in the same plate and just try to kind of keep together no matter what. Because he opens that section with, don't forget there is one body, one spirit, one Lord, one baptism, one hope, etc. Right? And those are not negotiable. So the unity is not a free-for-all, tolerate whatever, don't ask hard questions about people, don't make an argument about what is right and true to following Jesus. So it's based on a common confession, but that common confession is held with love and compassion and a desire to be together with patience. And you can see, right, you have probably experienced this, you know, in different churches or different places you've been, or you certainly probably have heard of places like this, who will split very easily, that people will get upset and they will leave at minor things, right? Not that somebody stood up and said, well, you know, I don't know if Jesus was actually raised from the dead, maybe still in the tomb, and then there's a split, right? That's perhaps understandable. But things about, well, when are we going to have our worship times and is that convenient for me, right? Or I'm not sure I really like the preacher, the way the Bible classes are done, so I think I'm going to just kind of pack up and go over here. And then we think, well, is that the unity that Paul's talking about here? I mean, is that the keeping together of being patient and loving towards one another and willing to endure something that you might not really enjoy, but it's for the benefit of the church? So he says, be patient, have a long fuse, because you want to stay together as much as possible. Secondly, each of us is called to some form of ministry. We, in our larger sort of Christian language culture, we talk about like a minister as kind of the guy who gets up and talks the most. But that's sort of the fail to see the meaning of the idea of service here. Because Paul attributes to each of us a gift and a function in the church. And we live in the midst of, I mean, this is not just kind of a Christian problem, it's a larger problem, of a consumer culture. Right? You know, I kind of want to intake, right? I want to have all these things brought to my doorstep and just sort of receive everything. And it's all kind of at my fingertips to receive it. So we might come to church, to the church assembly, and think, well, I'm going to consume while I'm here. I'm going to listen to the person who gets up and leads prayers. I'm going to listen to the person who gets up and leads singing. I'm going to listen to the person who gets up and teach. And I'll just sort of take all of this in, and then I'll go home and go back to my life. But Paul doesn't envision Christians coming together merely to take from others. He also sees them as coming to give to others, right? To be ministers to someone else. When we get to the singing, in chapter 5, he makes that point about singing, right? Of giving that to others, right? That being part of Paul's thoughts about singing and worship. So a healthy church, no matter the numbers or the beauty of the building or any of the other things that we attribute value to, the maturity of a church is when each member knows what their gift is and has been encouraged and supported to use it. That's a mature church, according to Paul in Ephesians 4. That's what maturity looks like. And what that will take, as he ascribes leaders, helping that be found. And it sort of astonishes me, right, when we think about how that works. Like, we're good. Like, I can do this with my own children, even though they're almost 4 and 2, right? And are growing and developing now. But you can already see, here is where their talent is or their ability. You start thinking about, like, career. What career would they be good at doing? And we can do that with our children. Or, you know, when I taught high school, right, do that with the students in my class, right? Here are their gifts and talents that they can go to this career and do this and that. And so we're really good at doing it in those circumstances. But can we do that in the church? Can we identify in the people that sit among us, here is where your talent and your gift is, and let me support you as you use it? Because that's what will breed success in the church, which is far more important than somebody's success in their career. So when we think about our children, or our grandchildren, or the children that we have in Bible classes, or us as adults and keeping ourselves honest and open to new possibilities, that we have gifts and should use them to the benefit of the church. And that will take the guidance of leaders, with leaders being there at the forefront of equipping the Christians to know what their talents are and giving them opportunities and support to use them, right? Not just sort of saying, well, you know, I think you might be a good song leader, so why don't you just get up there and start doing it? But to be there to say, let me guide you and help you in developing that so you have some comfort and some ability to use that responsibly. Having the church doing that. So that these leaders are not given a bunch of talents and abilities because they then get to be the ones to use it and get all the glory or recognition. But they are given their abilities to guide others in using the abilities that they have. And let me use the example of a teacher. I'm not a song leader. So I'll use teaching because that's what I'm familiar with. And it's the way I've come to think about, all right, how do you do that from the pulpit or from the Bible class lectern to provide that sort of guidance and training up new teachers? And one way I've come to think about this is not merely to see the role of the teacher as dispensing with information of, you know, here's all the right answers to the questions that you're asking, right? And just kind of give you the nice package and say, here it is, right? Here's all the solutions. That's important, though I'm not sure if I always have the right solutions to the questions. But to say, here's what I think about it, but I've seen it as an additional step forward in helping train up new teachers to say, here's also how I have come to think that. Not just giving the final product, but also showing some of how you get to that point. Right? How do you think through a particular theological or scriptural question? Right? How do you come to find an answer about that? Or if you're going to sit down with a book of the Bible, right, how do you begin to get your mind wrapped around it and study it to know that you've come to some semblance of the truth. And so opening that up for other people to see and experience and see for themselves, not just what to think, but also how to think, right? A thinking process that is faithful to the mission of the church. And that's a responsibility of leaders. And I'd say leaders, sort of whatever form that comes in. Maybe they have an official title like elder, or they are the leader because they are a parent, or they're a leader because somebody looks up to them and respects them, and that makes them a leader. But that's the responsibility. Finally, seeing our goal as to be like Christ. And I want to dispense something right here. We often want to let ourselves off the hook here because we will say something like, well, of course, Jesus did that because he's Jesus. But I can't do that. He's Jesus and I'm not. Well, that is true. He is Jesus and you are not. But Paul here does not let us off the hook there and say, well, you might want to be like Jesus if you can, but if you can't, don't worry about it. He says, no, your goal is to grow up to be like him. Or 1 Peter 2, to walk in his footsteps. So that our goal is to be like him. Now, is that going to be difficult? Yes. Are there going to be days when the consequences of being like Jesus are too strong so we feel like we want to give up? Yes. Does that mean if I'm going to be like Jesus, I myself might end up on a cross? Yes. But that's where Paul says you need to be going. You are going to be like Christ. So then we go to the Gospels, and we read about him, and we think about him, and we envision ourselves being there watching him. And what would it look like for me to be like Jesus with my family, with my friends at work, in the church? What would it look like for me to be like him? Am I willing to sacrifice out of love for others? Am I willing to confront abuse when I see it? Like Jesus will confront abuse. Am I willing to go to the people who the rest of society does not want, that they are unclean, they are impure, and they need to be cast aside? Will I be the person that goes to them like Jesus was the person that went to them? Am I willing, as he was, to be killed rather than to kill? Will I be like him? And that's where Paul says you need to be going. That's what maturity looks like. It looks like Jesus. And we will find, if we do that, if we will put our feet where he did, we will find the balance between doctrine and love, between truth and love. Rather than trying to think, well, how do I balance those topics in sort of an abstract theory of how do I do that? If we would conform ourselves to living like Jesus, those things will fall into place. Those things will take care of themselves because we will be like him. Paul packs a lot into just a little bit of space there. So inclusion into this people of God that we've been talking about is something that is extended to all people. And the benefits and the rewards of that extended to all people, but also the calling to work being extended to all people. Because the victorious work of Christ makes it possible for us to be a unified body, a maturing body, a working body. But to be in that body, again, to think about our Christian journey as kind of being wrapped up in a moment in which I decided to be a Christian and was baptized, right? Is that sort of being the end result, is to miss the vast majority of what Paul talks about. He sees baptism merely as the beginning of your life in Christ. Itself not the goal, it as the entry point into the way of life that lives in obedience to Jesus. And that will mean getting to work. So the question before us is, are we willing to do that work? You might not, at this point, be a Christian. You might not have put your entire life's trust in following Jesus, repented of the things that have merely led you away from him rather than towards him. You may not have been baptized and have those things forgiven to be immersed in Christ, be resurrected with him. you may not be there, and you might want to be. You might want what's being offered. And the caution that I will give is understand the cost. Understand what that really means. What it really means to then live a life in obedience and allegiance to the true Lord of the world. Because there are those of us here, and I chief among them, who has not always counted the cost of what it means to be a Christian and what that life looks like. And I don't speak that way of some point in my past. I speak of that as sort of a daily struggle, right? To live in accordance with the will of Jesus. And so there are times in which we have to repent and say, I haven't been doing what being a Christian ought to mean, following him. But know, with the power and the forgiveness of Christ, it can be done. So if you're not a Christian, understand what it means, but it's perhaps a harder life, but it's a better life for it. A life lived in the image of Christ is the best life we could live. And that's what true joy would look like. True satisfaction would look like Jesus. And while it may be hard and challenging, that is what will be best for us both here and in the age to come. And so if you are prepared for that sacrifice, ready to submit yourself to him, be conformed to him, we invite you to come forward as we stand and sing.